So, Professor Dave Steele from the University of Warwick is an expert in protest crowds. And he took me on a tour of some of the key sites in Westminster while describing how political protest has changed or hasn't.
Well, this is New Palace Yard. This is what's left of a much bigger space that used to go right down to the river, right up to St Margaret's Church. And it came into its own as a protest site in the sort of late 18th century, I would say, by a lot of different groups, including, to begin with, the Lord Gordon's rioters, the anti-Catholic campaigners, basically. And that's kind of fondly referred to in Dickens' Barnaby Rudge. Quite interesting. And he gives a very vivid account of this space being so different from what it is now, with Parliament being an almost liminal sort of interface between people and Parliament. And right up against the houses themselves, you've got accommodation, flats, coffee houses, pubs, booksellers, and beggars, homeless people sending street food, all mixed up together. It's a really vibrant place.
Which is very different to what we're looking at now, which is several layers of security. There's railings around the sort of perimeter, and there's more railings inside. And so that whole space, this sort of square, the opposite side from the river, going right up to Parliament and Big Ben and the clock tower. And so when this starts becoming an area where people feel, and I suppose it's with the rise of the electorate growing, more people getting the vote, more people there for sort of feeling that they should be having an influence, people start congregating here. Do they feel like they're having any impact? Does protest work?
Yeah, it's a very, very interesting point. And the point about the people having the vote is what this was all about. And I suppose it really kicks off in 1818, 1819, and a lot of people have heard about the Peterloo protest. There's a whole series of reform meetings, people realising that if you want to end hunger, you probably need to get the vote in order to campaign for it inside Parliament rather than outside. But of course the point is location, and it's so important because what they knew, that if they held a meeting here, sort of bearding legislators in their den, if you like, they would get press attention. And that's what it's all about. It's not so much about who's there on the day, it's about press attention, and that goes right up to today.
Yeah, it's exactly the same as true now. And when we talk about protest, what does that look like? You're talking about it's sort of a meeting. Is it people giving speeches and people listening? Is it like today we see placards and banners and signs and chants and songs? What does it look and sound like?
Yeah, all of those things that we would recognise today. But I would have to say that these meetings were very, very long and quite structured. They had to get permission to do them here. They had to get permission from the bailiff of Westminster. Sometimes he would give permission, sometimes he wouldn't.
I mean, that's true today, isn't it? Like for protests in Parliament Square and things.
Yeah.
You need the police and the council and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And quite often they went ahead without that permission. But they structure it like official meetings. So they have to elect somebody to the chair. Minutes, speaker after speaker will come, and trying to get them to stop would be quite hard. And so, interesting for those who were interested, exciting for those who simply just wanted to come to a space like this, but potentially quite boring as well. But it was all recorded, and we don't really know whether these reporters were taking notes. There were some kinds of early kinds of shorthand available at the time, or whether these speeches were being given to the newspapers. But within even the early evening editions, were producing verbatim reports, and then they'd get copied and put, yeah, and they'd be across the whole country within a couple of days. And so, the point was the way the message progressed and amplified out.
It's so interesting, though, that sense of if you want to spread the news of your cause, coming here and doing it, you're not only, possibly influence politicians coming and going, but there's journalists here, can't quite see, but the sort of the top floor of the House of Parliament that we're looking at, that's where all the journalists sit. Yeah. You've got the Guardian room and the Telegraph room and the Mail room and the Express room. And so when you've got protesters out here with their loudspeakers now, the main people who can hear it are the journalists. And actually, that's sort of what they want, because they hope that might influence. And that was happening, all those years ago.
Yes. I mean, they did get their message into the chamber, and a lot of these meetings are referred to in debates, but possibly because the MPs have read about it in the newspaper, not because they've heard it. It only takes one. I mean, Brian Hoare had a protest here for 10 years after the Iraq War, and he camped out, and he had placards all over there. And
he had his tent literally on the edge of Parliament Square, didn't he, on the grounds?
Yeah, and there's actually a move to have a statue of him erected. So these things have, they're not just about what happens there and then. They enter the sort of collective memory, as these early protests did.
There is a debate, isn't there, about how much protests achieve. I mean, actually, there was one school of thought that maybe the suffragettes were so militant they might have held it up. And you see it, we've seen it more recently, whether it's, I don't know, poll tax riots and Margaret Thatcher refusing to give way, or tuition fees, you know, protests that went down through here. And that sort of sense of sometimes governments want to see to be what they don't want to seem to be giving in to what they would call the mob, on whatever the issue might be.
Yes, yes. They certainly don't want to be seen to be weak or giving in the time. But when you look at subsequently, most of these protest movements, there's a kind of sense of deferred success. Now, it doesn't seem much like that, no concession, you know, to the people that are involved in that at the time. But if you take the Chartists, for example, 80 years later, everything's achieved. Same with the poll tax that you mentioned. Yeah. You know, most of those protests weren't in Westminster, but I mean, they were offshoots of them. But yeah, within a couple of years, the poll tax is gone. There's a kind of sense of, they don't want to be seen to be listening, but generally it's taken on board. It might be a subsequent administration, not that one, that does it. But some of these things, they're just kind of ripe for change, whichever shade of government's in power. It's a case of when, not if.
Has technology changed protests? Has sort of gathering in big groups, listening to long speeches and all of that sort of fallen out of fashion? People think, well, I've done my bit. I've posted something on social media. I've signed an online petition, which actually is so easy. Yeah. You know, that's not the same as giving up a day or even camping out for 10 years in a tent.
No, I think it has. Yeah, I think it has. But there's two sides to that, because through social media, the information networks work more quickly.
Yeah.
And then you've also got the 24-hour news cycle, which has a huge effect. I mean, sometime in March this year, there was a protester that scaled the Elizabeth Tower with Palestinian flag. And it took nine hours or something before they managed to figure out how to safely get him down. In that time, this thing went viral, worldwide, global. And that got more news coverage for one person doing that in this important location than weeks and weeks of the
Palestinians. Thousands of people literally walked down past him on those protests. Yeah,
yeah. And that hadn't that had got on the news, but it hadn't gone global in the same way as this thing did. Yeah.
So, Dave, at some point the protests moved from New Palace Yard. If we cross the road, while we still can, because it's on green. If we cross the road onto Parliament Square, and there's this sort of move, is the barriers and the railings go up, that protest sort of crosses the road?
Yes, yes. This came much more into its own in the 20th century and 21st century, I would say. And this was part of New Palace Yard originally. I mean, it's quite an interesting space. This whole area, right down to the river up to here, was part of a sort of Norman, this is a Norman castle. This is like the outer bailey, if you like. It used to be sort of jousting area and all sorts of stuff. So,
but it's been a place that people have gathered and done all sorts of things for years.
But it's quite small. I mean, the capacity of the New Palace Yard area is probably about 10,000 or 12,000. I mean, they would be publicising meetings having 200,000 attending. It's because absolutely not possible to that.
So it's not a new thing, organisers of protests slightly over-egging up the numbers.
But I mean, everyone used to over-egg the numbers. It was quite important in the 1840s for the government. If they'd spent a huge amount of money bringing troops and police in to police a protest that was then peaceful, it's no good them admitting there was only 20,000 people there. They needed to say there
so
was
even 20. The government and the police would say it was high.
But this space, I mean, this in Parliament Square, we probably got maybe 25,000, 30,000 40 if you don't mind getting very cosy with the people next to you. So nowadays, when the protests, London protests, and there were a lot around the time of the Brexit, People's Vote March, NHS anniversaries, all that sort of thing, and the protests started coming, sort of congregating around Hyde Park, Oxford Street area, and coming down here, and then this would fill up rapidly, and they'd be backed up right along Parliament Street, almost into Whitehall, simply because you couldn't get enough people in here. And the thing about this space is that it's very photogenic from the air.
Yeah.
And so during the People's Vote March, there was a banner unfurled, and it gets into all the newspapers. They're led by Donkeys people who have really, you know, switched on with social media. They did a genocide banner on here where they unfurled the whole thing. So, yeah, it's a useful piece of space, but it's quite small. But, again, it's the significance of the location, not the size.
And then when you've got aerial photos, if you can see the Houses of Parliament in it and, you know, Downing Street's just up there, and then you've got this big space to sort of use as your canvas.
Absolutely, yeah, really. And those guys are quite good at that. So yeah, the use of that, you know, initially, helicopters, drones, or CCTV surveillance, but it actually works in the protesters', you know, interests as well. So.
That was Dave Steele, who is a professor of history at the University of Warwick and an expert in protest crowds. And it doesn't just